Hello, and welcome to this week's edition of Books and Booze. We are once again being brought to you by the Booked Anthology. We are here with Scott Phillips, author of, among several other things, Rake, The Ice Harvest, The Adjustment. We'll be talking about a lot of different things on the show. This is Renee, and I'm having the Stone Collaboration R&R Coconut IPA once again. Scott, how are you doing, and what are you drinking tonight?
I'm good. You know what? I'm drinking a triple. I'm going to have to go get the bottle because well, hold on. I'm going up the stairs. Can you hear me? Can you hear my footsteps? Yeah.
This is real.
This is like old-time radio. Okay. It is a Brewery West triple, and it is from San Jose, California. It's a Dutch style triple rather than a Belgian style triple, I guess, or maybe the Dutch part of Belgium. And it's really nice. I'm digging
it. Nice.
Jessica,
what are you drinking? Yes. I think I know the answer.
I have Blue Moon Pumpkin Harvest Ale. I said it backwards, Harvest Pumpkin Ale, because I'm going to be drinking that until...
I thought of you when I passed the 12-pack of that in the store today.
You passed the 12-pack by?
Of pumpkin beer, yes. I'm not a pumpkin beer person.
Yeah.
It's so yum. It's the highlight of my year.
Some of them are really good. Some of them are, you know, I think Dogfish Head does a really good pumpkin beer.
Really?
Yeah, some of them are really, you know, just like, oh, look, it tastes like, you know, it tastes like Halloween candy, and it's just
yeah.
But there are a few I've had that I really like.
I don't know, maybe I'll venture into those waters again, but my husband's from England, and he has, like, a really big problem with the way that we put pumpkin into everything in the fall.
He
bought a six-pack of pumpkin ale when we were first dating as a joke, and we tried it, and I was like, okay, you win this round, because this is fucking terrible.
Yeah, there's some things, you know, but I think if you get a good brewer, you can put, you know, you can experiment and just get something good out of a lot of surprising things. And then sometimes I think if you're just, oh, it's Thanksgiving, let's put some turkey in the beer, oh, you know.
Oh, God.
Looking awful.
It really freaks me out when fish and meat are involved in beers. Like if I know that there's fish, like the fish-wise stuff, involved in the brewing process, I can't enjoy my beer.
Well, you know, there was a thing about 20 years ago where in Britain there were some vegans who set out an alert because they had discovered that Guinness, at some point in the brewing process, and I'm not joking about this, you could probably Google it, but at some point in the brewing process, Guinness used fish bladder to filter the beer. And
Guinness still uses fish in their beer.
Well, it was a fish bladder used as a filter, and under no circumstances should a vegan drink Guinness. And I remember thinking, that's pretty interesting. That's
the thing is, I have yeah, well, I have vegan friends, and they're big beer drinkers like I am, and she posted a list of vegan-friendly beers. I was like, wait, does that mean that there are beers that have like meat in them? And she gave me a list, and Newcastle uses fish. Guinness still uses fish. Like, there's a lot of beer that now, every time I think about it, I'm like, oh, God, no.
Well, it's not that there's fish in the beer. It's that, that fish products are used in the brewing process. I think it's a filtration thing. Also, don't forget there are a lot of beers with lactose.
Yeah.
That doesn't bother me as much because, like, milk is a beverage.
Yeah, but it's still, if you're a vegan, it's the
same. If you're vegan, it would bother you, yeah.
But if you're a vegetarian... Like, it's the ones that aren't vegetarian that freak me out. Things that are involved in beverages can be in my beverages. Things that are supposed to be on my plate, I don't really... Like, I'm going to save drinking my fish and my meat for when I when I'm old and I don't have any teeth.
Yeah. Well, you know, have you ever had, I'm not joking, pureed salt cod? Actually, I am joking. That's not a thing.
Dakota, what are you drinking? Is it pureed salt cod?
Oh, well, actually, this is the first episode I've done sober, which is very crazy for me.
I don't think
but
it's
since
the first.
I always, oh,
yeah, I don't think
not.
It's the first either. When you were last semester, you were drinking like coffee on a few episodes.
Oh, probably.
You don't remember
oh,
them
coffee.
Because apparently afterwards you were. But
right.
I was drinking coffee and wine. I remember now because I was trying to stay awake while also catching. Yeah, this is the worst
so what
Irish
are you
coffee
drinking?
I've ever.
Are you just having water? Or
I'm drinking Faygo because I'm poor. And
oh my god! Are
yeah,
you a double
Faygo? Did you say Prego like the sauce?
I've been hanging out with ICP all week. It's been a strange experience.
Faygo.
But I always have a fake drink that I'm drinking now. So this time I'll say it's Johnny Walker Blue Label.
I think your fake drink should be pureed salted cod from now on every episode.
Yeah. Well, you know, and the thing is, you can put some you can put some gin in it, and no one can tell.
Oh.
You know what? I actually had gin the other night, and it was, I didn't know how to make a martini, so I was rushing around the gas station asking the clerk how to make a martini. She had no idea. So
yeah,
I grabbed,
because they all know.
So I grabbed some 7-Up and some mineral water, and I mixed it all together, and it wasn't
7-Up.
Bad.
That sounds like the greatest martini ever.
The gas station lied to you.
I didn't, she was no help at all, so I just started grabbing things.
That's like a watered down 7-7, isn't it? Like, it's not, that's not a thing.
It, well, it was Seagram's gin, so it worked, I think. They go together.
So it worked.
All right, so.
Delightful.
God. you've got two books, one written, one in the planning stages, and they both feature Bill Ogden of Cottonwood and, the grandfather of Wayne in The Adjustment. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that.
It wasn't really planned. I had an idea that I was going to write a book set at the beginning of the American involvement in World War One, and I also wanted to set it in Hollywood, and I wanted this character, Bill Ogden, to be a central character, if not the central character of it. And around the same time, my friend Court McNeil, who is unfortunately has since died, suggested that he would like to publish a collection of Western novellas. And I said, well, I have this section of this novel, Cottonwood, which featured this character, Bill Ogden. And I said, I have, you know, about 100 pages of it from the middle that I had to cut out for reasons of length. And it kind of works as a novella. And he said, yeah, let's do it. And I sent it to him, and he said, well, you know, you should try to get this published. And long story short, my publisher at Counterpoint, who published, Dance Matanka, my editor there, who published Adjustment and Rake, said, yeah, let's do it as a novel. So I amended it a little bit. And it's set in Denver in the 1880s. The Cottonwood is in two parts. It's Kansas is the story of a family of murderers in southeast Kansas around 1873, and then a couple of women are arrested in the 1890s and falsely accused of being the women of the family. But there was a whole section that I'd written of the book that was in the 1880s in Denver. And so the novella turned into a short novel, which is now going to come out next year, and it doesn't have a title yet, although my editor wants to call it Hop Alley, because it's about a riot in the Chinese section, the Chinatown of Denver in the 1880s that really happened. So anyway, Bill obviously survives all of that, and I hadn't really intended to do two novels in a row with the same character, but just that's kind of what happened, because this one was already written, more or less. So strange commercial fate, and that you don't often get asked to write a sequel to a novel that sold less than 5,000 copies.
Well,
you know, over 10 years, you know, wow, it's the public is clamoring for more.
Kind
well,
of.
Well, I have to say that the Wayne Ogden character is an awesome character, so I can't wait to read more of his grandfather then.
Well, his grandfather is a little bit different from him, but they kind of spring from the same. I mean, I wrote Bill, the grandfather, after I had written a novel, The Walkaway, which had Wayne as one of the main characters, and I kind of had this idea that Bill would be kind of Wayne but not evil, you know, sort of an opportunist and a ladies' man and a guy who will do almost anything to make a buck, but just kind of without Wayne's nihilistic/evil streak. And I really love both of those characters. I really like the way they think. And even though Wayne is evil, I mean, and I will come right out and say, yeah, Wayne is evil. Wayne is a bad guy. And he gets worse. I mean, if you haven't read The Walkaway, there are a couple of short stories that I wrote, a couple of long short stories I wrote with that feature Wayne in his teens back in the 1930s. In one of them, he seduces and, in fact, sodomizes the mother of one of his high school classmates. And in the other one, he kills a bald eagle. And in those
stories, he's not a patriot.
Well, he doesn't really mean to. At first, you know, he shoots this bird that he thinks is a hawk. It turns out to be an eagle, and the eagle turns out to be really hard to kill. But he eventually manages. And the funny thing is, people always think this story is an allegory or some kind of political thing, which probably at some level it is. But it also really happened to my uncle in 1952 or 3. He went out with his buddies, and they were shooting crows in western Kansas, and they shot what they thought was a hawk. And farmers used to shoot hawks all the time, you know, sure. on the theory that they, you know, they kill chickens and da da da. And so, so my uncle just shot at this hawk, and it turned out to be a bald eagle. Nobody had ever seen a bald eagle in Kansas. You know, none of these guys ever had. Now they're a pretty common sight, but at that time it's like, yeah. Oh, shit, it's the national bird. We're in trouble. So it landed, and to make a long story short, if you want the long story, it's the story is called Crow Killers. but the short version is they had a hell of a time. They decided they wanted to stuff it and make some money, and so they threw the bird in the trunk and they hit it with a tire iron and they tried to, you know, kill it with an ice pick, and this bird just would not die.
Oh, my God.
So anyway, I have Wayne in that story and the one where he fucks his classmate's mother in the poop chute. And in those stories, you know, he's kind of a rascal and kind of a rogue, but he's not really evil. But if you go to The Walkaway, which is the first thing I wrote about him, it's set in 1952, and he's AWOL from the Army, and he's a bad guy. I mean, he's a murderer. He's a kind of a conscienceless murderer. He's not entirely conscienceless. This is more like drunk history all the time. But he he's a different guy than he is in those short stories. And so when I wrote The Adjustment, I kind of wanted to see him in that transitional mode. He's just come back from World War II. He's trying really hard to be a civilian and a father and a husband, and he just realizes he can't do it. So he goes back to the Army. And at some point, I'd like to do a book of him between The Adjustment and The Walkaway, where he's in occupied Japan being a pimp and a crooked supply sarge, and just get into his whole story. The way the character came up originally was I was reading the French newspaper Le Monde, and there was a great article about this guy who had – he was a Frenchman who had been the first modern bank robber in Japan. And he had gone into a bank with some Japanese gangsters and a couple of European guys and maybe some Americans, but they were all wearing American military uniforms. And they held up the bank, and all anybody could remember was, well, they were American soldiers, I'm pretty sure of that, you know, and some of them were, you know, Asian, but they were American soldiers because they had those uniforms. And that was all anybody could remember. And this guy got away with it for years. He was eventually caught, but I just thought, okay, what happened to the supply sarge who sold them the uniform? And that was kind of where Wayne came from.
Wow. And that kind of brings us, we had a listener question from Keith Rawson, and he asked, is Wayne Ogden going to be appearing in any more of your stories?
Well, like I say, I would love to do Wayne in that, you know, that 5 or 6 year stretch between 46 and 52 where he's, you know, this crooked supply sergeant in Japan and pimp. And the trouble is, it's a lot of research. I mean, I really have to learn about occupied Japan and the way the army worked and the way the black market worked. And I would love to do it, but I'll only do it if I make enough money at some point that somebody will send me to Japan.
I think we'd all like to make that much money. So I'm going to follow that listener question with a slightly related listener question.
Uh-huh.
Eric Beatner says, your Wichita books are loosely connected. And he wants to know if that was intentional when you started each book, or did the connection sort of occur later?
Well, the first book I wrote, you know, on its own, and then the second one I knew was going to be connected to the Walkaway. I knew was going to be connected to the Ice Harvest because it involved the elderly couple who play a large part in the end of that book, and I won't say what they do, but they end up with some money. And that book, the elderly couple, the wife is the mother of Sydney, the bartender in The Ice Harvest, and Sydney also appears in that book. And so when I wrote my third book, I kind of wanted it to have some links to those characters. And Bill Ogden in Cottonwood is the grandfather, the illegitimate grandfather of Dorothy, who is the wife of the guy who walks away. She's a character in The Ice Harvest, and she's kind of been a character in more books than any of the others, although she's always a minor character. At a certain point it became deliberate, but it kind of just happened. But I like it. I like the fact that they all sort of know each other. It's like, this is going to sound really stupid, but I just loved back in the old days when you'd watch Petticoat Junction and there'd be Mr. Drucker in his general store from Green Acres.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and these guys would appear on the same, you know, and it just seemed like, you know, okay, they don't really meet, but here's this guy who's the link between these two kind of slightly dumb universes.
And it kind of makes me think, and you'll excuse me for just totally going off genre here, but it kind of makes me think of, like, the Castle Rock books, by Stephen King. And then in the end, he literally, spoiler alert, at the end, when he decided he didn't want to write about those characters anymore, he literally blew up the town that he had created. He just wiped it off the map so that he could start over.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly understand that urge. There are characters you love killing off. And it's not just bad characters. I don't want to kill off, you know. But there are certain characters that you know, people like and you kind of get tired of them. I mean, I totally understand Conan Doyle killing off Sherlock Holmes. And I totally understand his bitterness at having to resurrect him.
Yeah.
Talking about your characters, two-part question here. I was wondering, are any of your characters based on people in your real life? And also, do you have a favorite character that you've written?
Not really. I kind of, you know, I go back and forth. Gunther in The Walk Away and Bill Ogden and Wayne Ogden, oddly enough. I mean, I really like all those characters for different reasons. Nobody major is based on anybody in my actual life, although occasionally I will, like the postman in The Ice Harvest, who actually appears in the movie, although he's not, as in the book, dressed and in real life, dressed in a postal uniform in the movie. He was a real guy who I used to see circa 1980 at this one place called the 49 Agogo outside Wichita. I was on 49th Street. And it was the diviest place, you know. I mean, it's just horrible. And I remember I was there one night with some friends of mine and this old guy in a postal uniform. He's way too old to be a postman. I mean, he was clearly past retirement age. I mean, I guarantee he's dead now. But he was there. He's like, "Go on, boys, give her a tip. Tip her, boys, she'll show you a good time. Oh, all right, boys." And then I don't even know if I should tell this, but I've told this story in print before, so I'll just go ahead and tell it. I pulled out a dollar, because this is a long fucking time ago. I pulled out a dollar to go to the bar and get another beer, and the dancer grabbed my wrist and with one hand took the dollar and with the other hand guided my hand between her legs and gave it a good stroke. And then the old man, the old postman, said, see, boys, tip her. You can take that hand home and smell it all night.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, So that guy was real. that guy was real, and Renata in that book was also loosely based on a real person that I knew, a woman, a very beautiful woman who owned a strip club, and she never stripped. I don't know of anybody who ever slept with her or claimed to sleep with her or claimed to know anybody who slept with her or claimed to know of anybody she slept with. But she was gorgeous, and we kind of got to be pals because my friend John, you know, was a bartender there. And, you know, for some reason she took a liking to me. But she was this gorgeous, gorgeous woman, and it was the kind of place where the dancers were kind of, you know, fucked up, kind of methy, you know, hard luck cases, and they were by and large, you know, they weren't Vegas showgirls.
I really like that descriptor, kind of messy. I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah,
but I've never heard it put quite that way.
Jailhouse, you know, jailhouse tattoos and, you know, vacant expressions, and some of them were very nice. I don't mean to. I hanging around with those women and hanging around with my friend John kind of during the dead hours. I would come in around 4 o'clock and before the businessmen started coming in from downtown after the offices closed. And, you know, I just sort of sit around the bar talking to my friend John and talking to them. And I came to realize that, wow, this isn't something exotic or exciting or even particularly naughty. It's just a shitty job. It's just a shitty job where people get to look at your tits. And that was a big factor in, I don't think I could have written the Eye Service had I not gotten to know some of those women.
So I kind of, I guess I'm going to follow up with that. I have a, when I prepare, I like to read a lot of reviews to kind of get like the feeling that other people had about the book.
Mm-hmm.
And over again about the Eye Service, people were saying like none of these characters were likable, but it was still a really good book. And I guess I was wondering how you feel about this like trend. There's like a trend emerging, and then there's also like an equal backlash against this trend. The backlash is mostly from writers, so I don't know if that actually counts because the readers are saying, you know, I need a likable character. I didn't like any of the characters in this book. So now that seems to be like a driving force in a lot of reviews that I read about a lot of books and advice that you'll hear, like, about how to get published. And so I just wonder how you kind of feel about that. Like, fuck them. You don't have to like them.
Well, you don't have to like them. You have to identify with them. And that's a key thing. I mean, that's, you know, Charles Williford was somebody, and I'm always quoting this guy. I wish I could remember who it was. I think it might have been the guy who published the research editions of a couple of his books. But someone in an essay once described Charles Williford as being the master of the asshole protagonist. And if you've ever seen the movie, which is a very faithful adaptation of The Woman Chaser, Robinson DeVore, who is just about to release an adaptation of You Can't Win by Jack Black, which should be just amazing. But he did a really good adaptation of The Woman Chaser by Williford. And I got through Dennis McMillan via Betsy Williford, Charles Williford's widow, a copy of the uncut, of the director's cut of the film. And it was changed for release because they took a couple of things out. And one of the things they took out was the main character has this woman who's following him around, and it's a character he sleeps with early in the novel, and she's trying to get his attention. And he's like, I'm busy, damn it. I'm busy, damn it. And in the uncut version, and I'm watching this with my wife, in the uncut version, she finally catches up to him and says, I'm pregnant, you moron. And he says, all right, I can take care of this. Patrick Warburton, Putty from Seinfeld. And he says, all right, I can take care of that. And he punches her in the stomach.
Oh, my God.
And she goes down. He says, that ought to take care of it. And then he goes about his business, which is burning a building. He's an arsonist. And at that point, I turned to my wife, and I said, he's lost you, hasn't he? And she says, no, I'm with him. And I thought, that is something magical. When you have a character doing something as wrong as that, and the audience is still with him. And that's the thing. You know, there's a lot of likable characters who aren't very interesting.
Absolutely,
Fuck likable. Likable is really boring.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I feel like, you know, a good example of that is Breaking Bad, right? One of the most popular shows on television. I mean, he started out kind of likable, but if you still like him at this point, there's probably something wrong with you.
Well, I like him.
He's a really terrible guy.
But I'm with him. Don't you know, like last night's show or this week's show, you know, when he, hey, how are you doing, brother-in-law? How are you feeling? You feeling okay? Oh, by the way, I found this thing on my car, and the brother-in-law turns on him and says, you're Heisenberg, you bastard. And he says, yeah. He says, I don't even know who you are. He says, oh, well, if that's true, I guess you should tread lightly.
Well,
yeah.
I could talk all day about how that's like the best written television show in like decades. But I think what makes him likable is that you remember him in the beginning and you see how everyone around him is suffering, and so you kind of just want to believe that everything will turn out okay.
You're in his shoes. You've been with him from day one, and everything they've had him do, you know why he's doing it. You may think he's wrong. You may wish he hadn't done it, but you know why he's doing it. And that's a crucial thing. You can make an audience, it's not an easy thing to do. And I think Breaking Bad is a very Willifordian kind of a story. You take a guy who's eminently likable and sympathetic with a terrible, terrible problem, and you have him do something drastic, and the drastic thing he does pulls him down. But at the same time, you're in his shoes almost as a viewer.
Yeah.
Well, I just read an article about a kid with cancer who was a big fan of the show. Yeah, he was a huge fan of the show, and it was because he liked that Walter took charge.
Walter was in charge of his cancer, and the kid admired that. And I have to admit, I teared up a little bit when I read that.
I did, and for the listeners at home, and I'll link the story. He actually got to meet Vince Gilligan and the cast and rejected an opportunity to hear the ending. And he actually passed away before the most recent episode aired. So he said he wants to find out.
Else,
yeah. So it is like, it's pretty emotional. But nonetheless, I think that, the point is kind of interesting that this kid, who probably wasn't a terrible person, who would like try and,
he was
white. He just related to the idea that you could take control of your life in the face of something as serious as terminal cancer.
I think the world is a lot poorer for having one less 16-year-old who was able to appreciate and understand something as morally complex as that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh. I'm not a terrible person myself, by the way.
Yeah, you are.
I feel like I have to mention that at this point because I write these stories about people who, from the point of view of these people who are, just doing awful, awful things. A friend of mine just posted a review of Rake, and there's a character in Rake who is a novelist. He's a very unsuccessful French novelist, and he has published a book, and our narrator is reading the book and thinking, what the fuck is wrong with this guy? And my friend describes the plot of this book in her review, the book within the book, and I'm thinking, that's not the book. That's the book within the book. That's the book I'm describing. It's not a book I actually wrote. But this guy is a terrible person. He's a French sexual tourist, and he goes to Thailand and has sex with every prostitute he can find, and especially looking for ones who look like they have advanced AIDS. And then he goes back to France to have sex with and impregnate and hopefully infect his own sister. And and I just thought, well, it's loosely based on there was a guy I knew years ago who tried to sublet me his apartment. And he had written this novel that he was really proud of because it was so shocking. And I was thinking, well, it's not really very good. I mean, I agree that it's a little transgressive, but it's not good in addition to being transgressive. And so I'm kind of trying to top him. And I think I did. I have like two or three little passages from the book that our hero is reading and thinking, oh, my God, this kid, what's wrong with him?
Just to set everyone's mind at ease, the three of us actually got to meet Scott in St. Louis, and we talked to him for a while at Subterranean Books, and he actually joined us for brunch the morning after our event, and he is genuinely, he's a very nice guy. So if you're having any doubt, We'll vouch for Scott.
I at least have that Ted Bundy kind of mask of sanity thing going.
Oh God.
I can feel that. Yeah. Hey, I was actually when I was in Subterranean Books, I picked up a Scott Phillips book, and I was like, oh well, this is cool. And then in walks Scott, and he actually signed it in blood. I don't know whose blood it was, but it could have been.
Yeah, but he just carries a little.
It was
pouch.
Weird that he had it. Yeah, that was.
You know, I
yeah.
hate to. I you know, I don't want to burst your bubble, Dakota, but that was squirrel blood.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
But talking about bad characters, though, I feel like the Charlie Arglist character from The Ice Harvest is just a bit misunderstood, maybe.
Yeah, he's
but
just lazy.
Also, I feel like I could justify that because I felt like I relate to that character, almost to the point that I want to go to law school and be a mob lawyer. I think that's how impressionable.
There are things about Charlie that you can identify with. Going back to the whole identifying versus liking.
Yeah.
But he's kind of a dick. And this is the thing, Scott, going back to when we spoke to you in St. Louis, you said that you felt that in the movie version, they made the wife less sympathetic and they just made her into a bitch.
Right. His wife is a bitch. And in the novel,
I don't
really
feel
is.
That way. I really didn't feel that way. I felt,
you wouldn't.
God, I'd fuck his brother if he was that big of a dick. Like, he's an asshole. He's a terrible person. He doesn't even think to buy his kids Christmas gifts until he's standing there in their Christmas party on Christmas Eve, and he's like, "Oh, shit, you got me on that one, son." Like,
yeah, well, and right, and he's just lazy. He's not evil. He's just lazy.
Yeah, see, I've dated lazy guys, so I'm on her side. I feel like she's an
incredible
character at both. In both versions. I felt like, so what? She fucked this other guy before they were divorced, but obviously they got divorced because he's a lazy prick.
Right, but she's got this smile on her face, this smug smile, and you know, in the book he looks at her and he feels this regret. He feels whatever kind of small amount of guilt he's capable of feeling. But he also feels this little bit of, he tried to remind him, you know, he feels this little, he notices that she's pregnant and he has this little stabbing pain and he has to remind himself that he hates her. And, you know, in the book, I hope it's clear that it's not her fault that they broke up. And in the movie, it's, oh, she's frigid, she sleeps with, you know, toe jammies and all that stuff. And, you know, no, it's Charlie was a lazy bastard. Charlie left because he just couldn't take, he didn't have the balls to go through with, you know, real life.
As a woman who's been in relationships and regrettably in marriage with a guy like that, I mean, it wasn't that dramatic. I would have written a memoir if it was. But a guy kind of like that, I can say that I found her very sympathetic in the movie. I kind of liked that she was a little bit of a bitch to him because he kind of deserved it.
Uh-huh. Well,
that kind of won her point.
It's not so much the acting as the writing, and I'm not knocking the script. It's just a different take.
I understand that.
You know, Russo kind of wanted to make it.
I'm thinking you're breaking up a little bit there, Scott.
Oh, sorry. There's a kind of a men's movement thing in the script. I think, you know, it's, you know, how shall a man behave in this? You know, and to me, it was like, no, Charlie is a lazy bastard, and that's why his marriage broke up, and. You know, and it wasn't easy for his wife. It's not easy for his kids. It's real easy for him because he's a lazy bastard. And so the movie, I think, lets Charlie off a little easy. Charlie gets a free pass in a way. It's you know, in real life, in Charlie's, in the book, Charlie wrecked this marriage because he didn't have the balls to just you know, be a man.
Here's what I don't get about Charlie is that I was thinking about this. He's a lawyer, so he steals, you know, for a living from people legally. But he's a mob lawyer on top of that. Why does he need more money and risking, you know, what everything he has?
He
now?
Figures out a way. He and Vic figure out a way to skim more than they're supposed to be skimming. I mean, they're supposed to be skimming. I had a friend who worked for the mob at a movie theater, and he was just a projectionist. But the manager was leaving. This is a Vegas-owned movie theater in Wichita, Kansas, called the Jerry Lewis Cinema. His boss was taken off for a month, and he said, "You know, you're the manager now. Here's what you do. You take 10% off and keep it for yourself and send the rest to the bosses in Vegas." And he says, "I'm not taking 10% off. I'm not stealing from the mob." He says, "Listen, you got to take 10% off. If you don't, they'll know you're not taking 10% off, and they'll figure you're really ripping them off, and they'll come out and try to find out how, and you don't want that to happen. So just take the 10%.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So
Kavanaugh and Charlie were just motivated by pure greed to skim even more than...
Yeah, they were just taking what they could. They had a system, and they figured out how to steal a little more. And then they got an idea that they were about to be found out, which they were, and decided to cash in and leave town. And Charlie was happy to do that because... I think being around town made him feel a little guilty. The occasional encounters with his wife and kid, places that reminded him of them, and I think he just wanted to go and be somebody else.
I feel like that makes sense. Yeah. So my question about the eye service is, why Christmas Eve? I have some theories, and you're free to tell me that they're all bullshit.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, a lot of it is I used to work in a shopping mall in Wichita. I worked there for probably, 6 or 7 Christmases, and I learned to really fucking hate Christmas.
Oh, yeah.
And I learned to hate the songs and the decorations, and it's taken me years to kind of get to the point where, in fact, it took the making of the Ice Harvest movie to make me ever like that song, The Little Drummer Boy. I hated that song. I hated it so fucking bad. But now when I hear it, it's like, thrum, thrum, thrum.
Is that why there's the whole debate about The Little Drummer Boy in the story?
Yeah, yeah. And I just love the idea that this guy thinks it's in the Bible. Because where did that story come from? It's just like some songwriter says, I'm going to write a song about a little drummer boy, Gene Krupa. That was just a silly thing. And I loved taking all the trappings of Christmas and using them in the service of a noir story. And I also, Christmas can be a very lonely, weird time. Depending on your relationship with your family and your loved ones, and it can be a very, kind of twisted experience.
Yeah, I get that because I live. My family's all here in California, and I lived in Maryland while going through a separation while working retail during Christmas.
Yeah,
so you've
got it.
That'll do it.
That reminds me, what was it like meeting Billy Bob Thornton and John Cusack? Those are the two people I mentioned that I'd want to drink with, and it totally slipped my mind before that they were in the Ice Harvest together. So,
well, Cusack was a very nice guy. He's enormous, like 3 years before, much taller than you would imagine him being. And he still has a big head for his body. I think know, he's got like the head of a horse. But he was a very nice guy. Didn't really hang around with him. We kind of toured the set together. Harold took us around on the set, and we talked about stuff, and so that was kind of fun. Billy Bob, I only met the one time. I met Cusack several times. But Billy Bob I met once, and he was totally in character as Billy Bob. I don't mean that he was in character as, you know, a funny character or something, but he was really on. I didn't feel like I was meeting the real guy. He was in makeup and everything, and he was very friendly. He talked about Scott Smith, who wrote A Simple Plan, and he kind of joked that, you know, I'm kind of making a career out of making movies, you know, film noirs set in snowy landscapes written by guys named Scott. And I said, well, I know Scott, and da-da-da, and we talked for a minute. But I never really felt like I'd connected with him. I think he's a very protected kind of a guy. I think he's a brilliant, brilliant actor and a really first-rate writer. But I have two friends who've directed him in movies, Harold Ramis and Terry Zwigoff, and they both say, you know, he's a very, very disconnected actor. But I've seen him in movies like, if you've ever seen the movie Crystal, which I highly recommend, CHRYSTAL, or Sling Blade, or, you know, there are these movies where he really comes and he really inhabits a character. And then there's movies like Bad Santa or Ice Harvest, where he comes along and he's great. You know, he does the Billy Bob thing, and you know, and that's, you know, he's not really revealing very much of himself. And that's kind of my reaction with him. I mean, I'd love to get to know the guy because I think he's brilliant, but I can't say that other than having had my picture taken with him and shaking his hand, I have any particular insight.
Well, that sort of leads me to my next question. With your experience being on set and things like that, if you had the opportunity, would you ever adapt your own work for the screen?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. In fact, I'm hoping to do Rake at some point. But, you know, Rake came about actually because they were doing a series of 13 novels for this French publishing house that's owned by a production company, and they were going to do 13 novels that were going to be 13 TV movies, and that's the reason I agreed to do the book. And then the movie series got canceled, the TV movie series got canceled, and so I was kind of left holding the bag. But, yeah, I would really like to adapt that, and I've thought about trying to do Cottonwood. And, you know, I say this having been very well treated by Rick Russo and Robert Benton, who did Ice Harvest, and for you know, despite what I said about the treatment of Charlie's wife in the movie versus the book, you know, that's just the nature of adaptation. That was Rick Russo's view of the character, and you know, that's kind of what you give up when you let it be adapted. These guys did a really good job, and they respected my work a lot. Jed Ayers and I did an adaptation of William Gay's first book, The Long Home. And it's funny because I remember when I first got one of the first scripts for The Ice Harvest, my feeling was every time I would come across a line that Benton and Russo had changed or invented, I'd say, well, that's not in the book. And every time I came across a line of mine that they had used verbatim, I'd think, well, I didn't write that, I wrote that. And you know, and I was very aware of the fact that this is just neurosis and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But when it came time to do William Gay's book, I found the very same thing in reverse. I would feel guilty. Every time I would write something new, I would think, wow, shit, that's not in the book. I'm betraying William Gay. And then every time I would use one of his lines, and there were so many beautiful lines in this book that, you know, you would just take one and use it verbatim, and I would think, I didn't write that. William Gay wrote that. We didn't write that. And so, you know, there's always this, there's a French phrase, traduire, c'est trahir, which means literally to translate is to betray. And I think it, you know, it's not exactly true, but
I saw an interview with Chuck Palahniuk at a film festival where he said when he sells the rights to a book, he views it as like giving it up for adoption, and he tries to stay as far away from it as possible because he wants the passion from the people to make it their own. And I have to assume some of the same feelings, just like it's got to be crazy. I have several part follow-ups, though, okay? So be ready because we're running out of time and I have some questions that I personally need to get in.
Okay.
One, what do I need to do to get you to introduce me to Harold Ramis? Two, reading the reviews of Ice Harvest, a lot of people either hate the movie and love the book or love the movie and hate the book. And I was wondering if you had any idea what you personally think might influence that, and if you believe that it might just be that our nation's collective love of John Cusack or our collective uneasiness about Billy Bob Thornton.
Well, okay, the next question, if you will come to Chicago with me, I will try to introduce you to Harold. I'll
work on that.
I'll just call me and say when, and I'll try and arrange something. In terms of the love-hate thing, people either, I think it depends on what they came to first. I mean, one of the problems we had with the movie was they cut the trailer, and it's a beautiful trailer. There's a great trailer for the movie, but the trailer makes it look like a buddy comedy. And they emphasize it by the director of Groundhog Day and Caddyshack. And so people, I think,
are
expecting a comedy. And, you know, so people who were expecting a comedy and got Blood Dripping on Christmas Presents were not thrilled. People who went expecting a film noir were like, oh, well, it's funny, it's a comedy, and I don't know. And so there were a lot of expectations. The funny thing about that is that the movie has had a really good second life. Yeah, it's on cable a lot. It's on streaming on Netflix now, and you know, it's had a pretty sturdy second life, for a movie that made, you know, $10 million at the box office or less. It's done fairly well, and I think it's the ending that really separates people. I think if you love the movie and were okay with the ending, and you read the ending of the book, which I won't give away, it's like, what the fuck? And
it's pretty different, yeah.
And if you love the ending of the book and read it and you see the movie, you're like, what? You know, I think that's part of it. What was the other question?
I was wondering if you thought that some of the love-hate might come from, like, people who are firmly in John Cusack's camp, or people who are, like, firmly creeped out by Billy Bob Thornton. And this is not a comment on Billy Bob Thornton's acting.
Yeah.
But personal life, sometimes the stuff that makes the headlines, it's a little weird.
I don't think that affects things too much. I mean, obviously, you know, Cusack is a great choice to play Charlie because Cusack can do terrible things and you still like him.
Yeah.
I mean, he's got that Walter White thing. I mean, Cusack, you know, Cusack would have been an interesting choice for Walter White.
Yeah, I would have watched that.
Because
that's the thing is that he's always, well, not always, after the 80s, after all the teenage movies of the 80s that he did, which I'm a huge fan of all of them in a really embarrassing way. But he always kind of plays like that weird kind of anti-hero sort of role, and he always manages to own it.
Yeah, he's one of those actors who doesn't, you know, he doesn't come on with a lot of facial appliances and, he doesn't have, Spock ears, you know, he kind of comes on and just, he looks like, I was thinking about this watching Edie Falco in Nurse Jackie and thinking, You know, it's really interesting that from a physical and voice point of view, she doesn't look or sound any different from Carmela Soprano. But when I watch Nurse Jackie, I never think about Carmela Soprano. And she's just got this thing where she does her own voice and her own face, and she doesn't, but there's something that's just coming from within that's, and I think Cusack is a similar kind of actor. Connie Nielsen, who played Renata, I think does not get the, and Connie is the one actor from the movie that I kind of got to know a little bit. Because we did some publicity in Europe. We did some publicity in France with Harold and hung around quite a bit. Had dinner with Roman Polanski, which was interesting and weird.
Whoa.
Yeah, I forgot to mention to him that, it's a long story, but I've had Twitter conversations with Charles Manson and I've had dinner with Roman Polanski, so...
That's a hell of a claim to stake on the world, I'm just gonna say.
Yeah. But anyway, and Connie was at that dinner, which is why I mentioned it. Anyway, Connie is she's a character actress. I mean she's different in every movie. She looks different, she sounds different, she is different. When I first met her in person, I had already seen the movie. She had already finished her scenes when I showed up on set. And so I didn't meet her until we were doing publicity. And I saw Harold and I walked up and there was a group of people in this hotel lobby. We were all about to go out to dinner and one of them was Roman Polanski and that was kind of creeping me out. And this sort of lovely, very tall woman turns to me and says, "Hi." I said, "I'm Scott." She said, "I'm Connie." And I said, "Are you Connie Nielsen?" And I did not recognize her. Because, you know, she just doesn't, she's very different in everything she does. And I think because she's beautiful, she doesn't really get the credit for the craft of her acting. And
I think that's a very fair point. I think that... although the beautiful actresses tend to get more roles, mm-hmm. that there is a certain amount of, she got the role because she was beautiful, and not necessarily taking in what they're actually doing and what they're actually accomplishing.
Right, and she would never deny that, you know, being beautiful, you know, she wouldn't say being beautiful never helped me get a role, but I think she doesn't really get the credit that she deserves critically because... You know, people look at her and say, "Oh, well, you know, fashion model, 6 feet one." You know, so anyway, that's acting is an interesting trade. I always think it's interesting to compare actors and writers because a lot of what we do is very similar, and it's pretending you're someone else for a little while and trying to make other people believe it.
Yeah. I've never thought about that before, but I think you're absolutely right. So we're actually a little bit over time now, and need to. Hi, it's been great. I need to remind everyone that this episode is sponsored by the Books Anthology, and remind everyone that it's a great anthology with stories from a lot of authors that have been on this show that you've listened to and love. And you know, in many ways, books pave the way for us because they run in some of the same circles, and they made people care about podcasts where people talk about books. And so we might not exist if it wasn't for them. I don't know. And again, thank you so much for a great episode, Scott. And
thanks.
Best for us. I ever make it to Chicago.
Thanks for having me on. If you can edit around so I can just say one more thing about the anthology.
Sure.
I have a blurb for the anthology. Buy it or die.
There you go.
Put that on with my name.
Buy it or die. Scott Phillips.
That's serious. We'll take back that thing about how you were nice, but yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's ridiculous. Please do take that.
Will literally kill you and sign books in your blood if you don't buy the book anthology.
Yeah.
There you go.
Damn straight.
There you go. So, as usual, we're going to hear a song, finish your drink. So, yeah, that's the end of the show, guys at home. And thanks for joining us this week. And thanks again, Scott. Great, great show.
Thank you, guys.
Smarter than